In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Let's talk movies. Pass the Popcorn, brought to you by Bangor Mall Cinema 10, Stillwater Avenue, Bangor, where they have a film for everybody in the family. Alan Adams from The Main Edge is with us. Greetings, sir.
Greetings. How are you?
I am well, thank you. You had quite a weekend, I understand.
I did. My lovely bride celebrated her college reunion. So we were down there in Brunswick. She's a proud graduate of Bowdoin College. And we went down there and did the whole shebang, like met up with some of her old friends. And I dutifully played the arm candy role that I was born for.
Oh, yes.
And we had a grand old time. It was a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Good for you. All right. Now, before we talk movies, I got to know, James Holzhauer, the big story today. Do you think it's real? And do you think he's done? And if you do, are you glad about that?
Well, this is something.
Or are you banned from talking about this?
Well, no, I'll lead with this. I believe it has been confirmed that it is the truth. It is a real thing. Only because apparently, because Jeopardy is a syndicated show, it airs at different times. There's apparently a market, I want to say in Arkansas, where it airs at like 9:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, who the hell is going to watch Jeopardy at 9:30 in the morning?
Really?
But apparently, so the word is out. And so by all accounts, this is a real thing that has really happened, unless they're really putting one over on us. I follow Mr. Holzhauer on Twitter, and he posted a couple of things that alluded to the possibility that this was real. I think my favorite was, I probably shouldn't have invited Drake to this taping, which I thought was pretty funny. But it's something like, as far as my feelings, like I'm still unpacking how I feel about it. Like I'm probably going to wind up writing about it for this week's edition. So we'll probably talk about it more on Wednesday. It's one of those things where, not now, I guess, is where I'm at. I wish it had happened either like 2 weeks ago or like in a week. Like, it's just one of those things where he's so close to sort of like setting another one of those marks. And then it's like, you know, after that, it's like, well, I mean, he was, you know, he's still like some 40 away from, like, he's not even halfway to Jennings. So it's like, whatever. But like he just needed one more good night to break the sort of the regular season winnings record. I think he's done okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's revolutionized the way people approach the game, I think. Now, I'm not sure everybody could do what he's done. Now, it's such a risky strategy.
Well, it's a combination of skills, I think. And, it's not just having the broad knowledge base, although he clearly has that. It's not just the sort of fearlessness with which he attacks the game board, which, I mean, he also does. There's also a great degree of, like, he's displayed a level of mastery of the buzzer that I don't think we've really seen before. There are a number of contestants out there probably every week who show up who are his equal in maybe one of those respects, but it's all three. It's like you put all the pieces together and you've basically constructed this sort of ideal Jeopardy contestant. I think it's great. I think we'll see plenty of him. Like, they're certainly, like, the show has certainly embraced the idea of celebrating the best among them, and so I have no doubt we'll see him again sooner rather than later.
Now, I was reading an analysis of his performances versus Ken Jennings, and it had some of the stats, and I was particularly drawn by the percentage of questions that they got right. And it wasn't quite as high as I thought it would be. And I was thinking back to your appearance, and man, I don't remember you missing many.
Yeah. I was superior to my opponents in terms of, buzzing in. Like, I answered more questions than everybody else. I missed a couple, but I think my overall percentage of questions correct was, I think I got like 82, 83 in there somewhere. But you see these guys and they're coming in at 90, 91, and it's like, you know, it doesn't seem like a big difference, but it is. Like, it's just like, you know, they're basically, they're missing one out of every nine questions. And, you know, that's, you know, a category and a half.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, and it just depends on which ones you're getting. So.
Right. Well, it's interesting to see, but sounds like it's coming to the ratings. I bet tonight will be amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's, and it's almost like, and, you know, it's, you know, they say spoilers. It's you know, it had kind of leaked, like I'd heard rumblings about it last night, but like it was confirmed pretty early on this morning. But it just means, like, I mean, I'm going to be busy tonight, but I'm going to set the DVR. Like, sure. I'm going to record it so I can watch it, because I'm going to want to see it, because it's one of those things where it's, you know, in that particularly niche pop culture history, like sort of game show kind of like, it's important. Like, it's a big deal. So.
All right, let's talk movies. You saw three this weekend.
I did.
Oof, where to begin?
Well, do we want giant monster fights, or do we want giant sparkly hats, or do we want to go streaming giants making rom coms? Like, whatever you want to do.
Let's go monsters.
Yeah, you want to do the monsters?
Yeah.
Okay. So I saw Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is the third movie in what I've decided to call the BAMCU, the Big Ass Monster Cinematic Universe, following 2014's Godzilla and 2017's Kong Skull Island. This latest installment, we open in the immediate aftermath of the first Godzilla movie, where we see two people. We see Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga wandering through the wreckage of San Francisco, shouting for their child, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And so we flash forward to 5 years later, so present day, where Vera Farmiga, who is a doctor named Emma Russell, she's a paleobiologist, I believe, is what they call her. I don't know if that's a real thing. That's probably pretty close to a real thing. But she is working with the super secret, except not as secret anymore, but still kind of secret, monster hunting organization called Monarch, where they are they have various like black sites around the world where they have sort of discovered the hibernating, they call them Titans. These are the aforementioned big ass monsters, of which Godzilla is one. But all these other sort of Titans are in various stages of repose, like they've sort of gone underground, and so she has been working on this device that was originally built from research done by her and her husband, the aforementioned Kyle Chandler, Mark Russell, and they go to this site in Mexico, she brings along her now teenage daughter, Madison, played by Millie Bobby Brown of Stranger Things fame. And they take the device called the Orca, which apparently uses something called bioacoustics in an effort to communicate with the Titans. And hence, through communication, perhaps we can establish some sort of more mutually beneficial relationship, as opposed to the wanton destruction that comes with, you know, skyscraper sized monsters wandering about all higgledy piggledy. So they go to this place and they turn on the machine, and their first experiment, it works. And they're staying with this one is Mothra. I don't know if you remember Mothra.
Well, of course I do. Yes.
That's one of the joys of this movie, is they go back to that, to the Toho well, and sort of reinvent some of the classics, which is really kind of nice, along with some new ones. So the device works. They're able to establish a line of communication with Mothra. But then immediately afterwards, a group of eco-terrorists show up, led by Charles Dance, the head Lannister guy from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
He's a former sort of disgraced British colonel named Jonah Allen, and he and his crew want to prevent the human race from, you know, doing all the damage that they do to the world, And he's decided that to do that, he's going to unleash the Titans, and they're going to basically scrub the Earth clean of the of mankind's influence, and then you know, and then everything could start anew with a new paradise, as it were. As you might imagine, the folks at Monarch don't necessarily want that to happen, and so they go out into the field to bring Mark Russell back into the fold because he's basically wandered off to take pictures of wolves, and so they bring him back. And it's the same crew from the first movie. So like, Ken Watanabe is back, Sally Hawkins. And then you've got a couple of new folks. You've got a sort of, snarky science guy, played by, Bradley Whitford, who's very good. And then a tech guy, Thomas Middleditch, is there as well. And they all basically come together, in an effort to prevent, Charles Dance, from using the machine to basically wake up the other Titans. And the big one is Monster Zero, or also known as King Ghidorah. He's the big three-headed dragon looking thing that you may remember from I think he just did the one Godzilla movie for Toho, but I don't remember. The deal is they wake him up. That's sort of another sort of alpha predator on the level of Godzilla. And then, it gets real. I mean, I could, the plot's so ridiculous and convoluted. I could go on and tell you some more stuff, but it doesn't really matter.
No.
You know, it's one of those things where all I want is giant monsters fighting.
Yes.
Like, you know, flying at each other and like shooting each other with laser breath and whatever crazy stuff that they do. And I get some of that. There's a good deal of that. Some of it's really beautifully rendered, and it's just like this wonder, and you get this really great sense of the scale of it, and it's really cool. On other times, they kind of fall into that sort of, you know, shuddery camera, quick cut kind of thing. Things are a little dark, and so it's tough to necessarily see all the details. But the biggest problem is they spend far too much time with the people. Like, I'm not interested.
Nobody cares about the people.
Like, I'm not, like, it's Godzilla, King of the Monsters. It's not, you know, family drama surrounded by, you know, occasional monster fighting. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here for I'm here to see Godzilla make that weird Godzilla noise and shoot his, like, crazy radiation breath.
Yeah.
And, you know, and kick some butt. Like, that's what I want. And so there is some of that. You get some nice face-offs. And again, I mentioned Mothra, Ghidorah, Rodan is in the house. You remember Gamera? He was the giant turtle that had jet engines for legs. he's there, although there are no jet engines, which I'm really disappointed with. Oh. It's like, why would you even bring back the giant turtle if you're not going to give him jet engine legs? But yeah, it's fine. I could have done with just two solid hours of monster fighting. Like, I don't really care about the, you know, bringing the family back together and dealing with the, you know, the emotional fallout of loss, because, you know, it's not that kind of movie. That's not what I'm here for.
All right. Let's go to rom-com then.
Okay.
Is this Netflix only or in selected theaters?
It's a Netflix joint. Always Be My Maybe. You know, I was curious about this. One of the things that has become painfully clear as someone who spends a lot of time at the cinema, you don't see a lot of the middle tier of movies has kind of disappeared in a lot of ways. Like, if it's not a big action tentpole, then it's something like super niche and like low budget. You know, it's kind of either or. Just because that's how the studios, you know, make their money. Like, that's the deal of it. But Netflix, being Netflix, saw an opportunity. And they've been, they spent the last couple of years really leaning into that, the sort of romantic comedy market. You know, and to great success, I think. I think they've generated a number of pretty solid offerings. I would argue that this one might be the best so far.
Wow.
Like, it's really good. It stars comedian Ali Wong and Randall Park, based on, and it's a script that they co-wrote, based on their real life sort of experiences. It's set in San Francisco. And it's basically, two people who known each other, grew up next door to each other, and they develop, it's the development of their relationship over the years. So you've got Sasha, who is a, played by Ali Wong, who's a celebrity chef. Like, she's a big deal, rising star on the culinary circuit. She's opening restaurants, like big deal restaurants all up and down the West Coast. She's got a big deal brand ambassador guy as her fiance, a guy named Brandon, played by Daniel Dae Kim. She's got a pretty great life, it seems. But in her past, she was kind of a latchkey kid. Like, her parents were both very hardworking. They owned a store, and so they were working all hours. So she spent a lot of time alone, which is where she learned to cook. A lot of that time was also spent next door, and that's where she met Marcus, played by Randall Park, and his family. And she was sort of like the second child almost for them. And so Marcus and Sasha grew up next to each other. They grew up together, best friends. In their sort of teenage years, there's a tragedy. I'm not gonna go into specifics, but it leads to them first connecting in a whole different fashion, and then basically parting ways and sort of leaving one another behind and going on different paths. So present day, Sasha's celebrity chef. Marcus never moved out, still lives with his dad, works with his dad in their heating and cooling company. Still playing in the same band that he started in high school. They're called Hello Peril. There are a number of songs that they perform, and they're actually quite good. I'm not gonna spoil it, but there are a couple of really solid songs that are a lot of fun to listen to. Sasha's going to open a new restaurant in San Francisco, so she has to come home. Her restaurant manager, who was sort of the third musketeer when they were in high school, springs it on her that Marcus and his dad are the ones who are doing the heat work on this rental house. So reconnection, and we see that sort of that relationship start to build again. She goes to see his band. He introduces her to his girlfriend. They start hanging out a little bit more. She winds up breaking up with the fiance because she thinks he's fooling around with her with Padma Lakshmi. And then she finds another beau. we need to talk about this for a second, Rich. It's Keanu Reeves.
Wow. Okay.
It's Keanu Reeves playing Keanu Reeves.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Keanu Reeves, who has had, I think in recent years, just a delightful sort of renaissance where he has fully embraced his role as sort of the internet's boyfriend, seems like a very good, very genuine, very thoughtful person. But he also seems very aware that it wouldn't take very much for him to come off, instead of a nice, genuine guy, to come off as kind of a D-bag. And so he leans into it.
Nice.
And we get D-bag Keanu Reeves. And it's like, it's all stuff that you could be like, oh yeah, I could see Keanu Reeves saying that. But there's an attitude change and a tonal change. And it's just like, the 15 minutes that he's in this movie is what elevates it from pretty good to great. Like, he's fantastic in this. We go through and, you could probably guess how it plays out. It's a pretty formulaic story, all things considered. Like, it hits all the rom-com beats. But the performances, like, Ali Wong and Randall Park are both exceptional. They have a great chemistry. They're actually real-life friends. Like, they met each other in college, I think. So they have that dynamic down. Their relationship is really good. It's really funny. She kind of tones down the acerbic nature of her stand-up persona a little bit. Like, the attitude's, the swagger's still there. It's just sort of dialed back a little bit. And again, you've got Keanu Reeves really going for it. Like it's just he's a delight in just so many ways that I can't really go into without spoiling. And you really just need to go in clean because it's awesome.
All right. And finally, the third of the three films you're talking about, the Elton John biopic Rocketman.
Yeah, I actually on Twitter kind of
you telegraphed it a little. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know. I honestly don't know how hot this take is, considering what sort of backlash we saw last year. I believe that Taron Egerton as Elton John is superior to Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury. And I think Rocket Man is a better movie than Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, and the fact that he's doing his own singing, to me, goes a long way.
It's remarkable, Rich. Like, I didn't know that much about Taron Egerton. Like, I've seen him in some stuff, and he's always struck me as pretty good. Like, he's a talented guy. But he's a Royal Dramatic Academy graduate. Like, and he auditioned. His audition song was an Elton John song.
Wow.
To get in, you know? Wow. So he's had this connection with the material for such a long time. And if you've seen any of the sort of like publicity junket stuff with him and Elton John, like the two of them have clearly connected in a real way. There's a great story about how every morning Elton John basically emails reviews of the movie to Taron Egerton. And it's just like, that's adorable. Like that's just precious. But yeah, it's a traditional biopic, but it's not. And what I mean by that is, like, it's a musical. Like, it's not, like, and it's not, we're not talking, like, stage performance, like, the songs. Like, the songs are integrated into the storytelling in a really interesting way.
But it's not a linear story, right?
No, they have a wonderful framing device involving a sort of a self-help group kind of setting. That works really well. So we bounce back and forth in time a little bit. We see, we meet little Reg Dwight on the outskirts of London in the 50s, like living with his distant mother and his even more distant father, who is in and out of his life. He's a military man, so he's only around. And we get to see as he sort of discovers his talents for music, and then as he works his way through and grows up and, you know, plays piano in the horribly named Bluesology. That's a band that he was apparently in when his first band. And it's just like, wow, that is a brutal name. That is a brutal name, Reg. And then he, you know, takes on the name Elton John, starts searching for an opportunity to do something more. The stars align and he meets Bernie Taupin, played by Billy Elliot himself. Josh Bell.
Oh, wow.
Bell? Josh Bell? Is that
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the magic happens and they start really blowing up and they make the journey to America, which is where he meets John Reed, played by Richard Madden, also of Game of Thrones fame, who is sort of the first love of Elton's life, although he proves to be a bit of an opportunist in a lot of ways. So there's a lot of stuff where he deals with the trappings of fame and the nature of sexuality and, you know, comes to terms with the emotional struggles that he has and how they're connected to how he grew up and all of this.
And I read, too, that Elton didn't want this thing prettied up.
No.
He really wanted to make sure that the dark side of his career and his life were portrayed.
Yeah, and there's plenty of that. Like, there's the standard sort of rock and roll, like, drinking drugs, et cetera, stuff. Although it's a little more graphic than you find in a lot of these things. But not, like, gratuitously so. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's treated honestly. It's also... And I saw this and it surprised me, but then I was like, I can't think of another one. It's the first mainstream feature to feature an actual love scene between two men.
Mm.
Like, and it's not graphic or anything like that, but it's there. It's very present. I have to say, I'm actually sort of pleased at the idea that it didn't register to me that it was anything strange.
Right.
But so, I mean, I suppose that speaks to the world that we're living in now, which is great. But the wonderful thing about this is how stylized it is. And it makes sense because if you're going to like if you're going to tell the story of someone who has you know, manufactured this incredibly elaborate persona, like, you know, in terms of, you know, visual aesthetic and all this stuff, something so over the top and so just incredibly bright and vibrant, like the movie should reflect that. And so from the very get-go, which is an opening number of the Bitch Is Back, that's almost entirely like all grayed out in the 50s suburbs. Like he basically sings a duet with his younger self. And we go from there, you know, there are a couple of just incredibly striking moments. They've alluded to some of them in the trailer. But there's this real element of magical realism to it all that it fits Elton John's story so beautifully. It fits the performer, it fits the man. And it's just like, it was just a remarkable movie to watch. And again, I'm someone like I love Elton John's music. So, you know, so there's a lot of that. And, you know, and you're sitting there and it's like, is he singing? Like, and that's the big thing. Like the idea that it's even a question, is really pretty, pretty exciting. But yeah, no, Egerton, like he does all the singing. He really embodies the role in a wonderful way. The performances are great. The music is fantastic. It's visually stunning. It's hysterical because the director is Dexter Fletcher, who's the guy who came to clean up Singer's mess on Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right.
And so this guy's clearly carving out a niche for himself. But yeah, it's a really well done movie. Like I said, it's not going to get a tenth of the acclaim that Bohemian Rhapsody did, and it's probably not going to do. You know, it's only going to do a fraction of the box office because that movie made almost $1 billion. This one's not going to do that. But maybe it should, because honestly, like I think the lead performance is better. I think the movie as a whole is better.
There you go. The lowdown from Alan Adams. Thanks, Al.
My pleasure.